So, hi everyone. Hope you're doing well this morning. So, last time we pretty much finished what I consider to be like the general theory of second quantization and second quantized operators. So now we're going to get back into doing actual physics. So we're going to look at an introduction to tight binding models, which is how we're going to study electrons on a lattice. And in particular, today we're only going to talk about one-dimensional lattices. But the first part of the course is going to, the first part of the lecture is going to be about a general idea for how we write down these kind of tight binding models in the second quantized language. So what we want to study is we have some atoms or ions or something. I'll say atoms. And they're forming some kind of crystal in, for now, one dimension. And I'm going to assume that they have a normal kind of hydrogenic Hamiltonian. So I'm going to write down the Hamiltonian of the system as a sum over electrons, the normal kinetic energy, plus now some potential energy, right? This. Something like that. So what we have is our kinetic energy for each electron, and then the potential energy that each electron has relative to each of the ions in the crystal. Furthermore, in general, we'd have a term like this. So this is the interactions between electrons, because it depends on the coordinates of both an electron I and another electron j. And therefore, we're going to ignore this. We will, however, add it back in roughly 2 weeks from now. But for now, we're going to ignore that piece. We're just going to pay attention to the non-interacting part.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
I guess I was just wondering how much this approximation of ignoring the electron-electron interactions actually changes the results for like a real crystal or something. Like, I totally get why we're doing it. I'm just curious. I've just never understood, like, when does that approximation break down?
So that's a very good question. The rough answer is that in most cases, you really can't ignore interactions, but it turns out that when you include interactions, what you end up with is sort of what are called quasiparticles, which act like non-interacting electrons, only certain values like charge and mass might appear to have a different value than their actual the value for the electron. But they otherwise act as if they're not interacting. So that's true for a very wide range of materials, which is something that falls into the idea, the category of Fermi liquid theory, which is unfortunately something I'm not really going to have time to talk about much in this class. So the short answer is you can't ignore the interactions, except kind of you can, and you just change this m to some effective mass m star, and then it works out fine. So it's sort of strange, but this sort of case of like when interactions kind of but not really matter is something I'm not really going to focus on the course. We're going to talk about non-interacting things, and then later on I'm going to go all the way to the other end of the spectrum and talk about sort of modern condensed matter, where we have very strong interactions that can't be ignored at all. So I don't know if that answers your question satisfactorily, but the answer is we really shouldn't ignore them, but we're going to anyway.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Okay, so now our question is, how to rewrite H in the second quantized form. So the answer we actually got last time. So if a second quantized H is in the form H equals sum on ij, Cij, Ci dagger, Cj, then H is completely specified by these coefficients Tij, or what I called last time the matrix T. And these Tij entries can be found by computing the following. Okay, so here I've just pulled the sum outside, and then I used the commutation relations on the first two operators and on the second two operators. But this zero with CK dagger is equal to zero, and this CL acting on zero is also zero. And hence, this whole thing is equal to sum on KL, TKL, times delta IK, delta JL. All right. Which indeed is just Tij. So this is actually a prescription now. If we have any H, we can feed it into this. We can feed it into this sort of formula in terms of some orthonormal set of single particle eigenstates, and what we'll get out is this matrix T, all these coefficients Tij, and that'll tell us what our second quantized Hamiltonian is. So I want to make one important note about this. So a note that the H in this formula can be just a single particle Hamiltonian, because of course the Tij is defined, as we talked about before, this matrix, this matrix T is just H restricted to the space of single particle eigenstates. So let me say that. Does this make sense? Okay. So let's go ahead and use this now. Our first step is going to be to pick our orthonormal basis of single particle eigenstates. Not eigenstates. Single particle orbitals. The orbitals don't need to be eigenstates. That is not needed. So pick an orthonormal basis of single particle orbitals, and then we'll find the matrix elements. Okay, so this is actually going to be quite challenging to do well. In particular, step one is, if you want to do step one properly, it's quite difficult. So the answer is we're not going to do step one properly. We're going to kind of cheat with step one. So now it's time to start making approximations. Okay, so what approximations do we want to make? To answer that question, let's think about what would be a good basis of single particle orbitals. What is like the most natural thing we can come up with? So I'm going to claim that a natural choice of basis is local atomic orbitals. So what I mean by that, is, let's suppose we have three sites, then my basis would look something like, my hydrogenic orbitals, NLM, on site one, same thing on site two, and same thing on site three. So for example, this would look like 1s on site one, 1s on site two, 1s on site three, 2s on site one, 2s on site three, 2s on site four, blah, blah, blah. So these are all independent orbitals from each other. And in total, they form some large set of single particle orbitals. So I want to make sure very clear, this is not something like phi one tensor phi two tensor phi three. This is not what we are talking about. What we're saying is a particle can either be on site one in one of the s, p, d, et cetera orbitals, or on site two, or on site three. But these things are all independent from each other. So now, can somebody tell me what's the problem with this basis set? Why? So this I think is the most natural thing to think of. But why is it actually, why does it actually not meet my step one goal?
They are not orthogonal?
That's right, they're not orthogonal. So for example, so here's a problem. They're not perpendicular. For example, the integral of the one, or the overlap of a 1s orbital on site one and 1s orbital on site two, is proportional to some exponentially decaying function where this r is the distance between atoms and this a is the Bohr radius. Which is, of course, not equal to zero.
But the orbitals belonging to the same ion or same atom are orthogonal. Only when we have these cross things are not orthogonal.
Yes, that's right. So all the orbitals on a single site are orthogonal to each other, but they're not orthogonal to ones on other sites. Okay, so there's a rigorous solution to this problem. Which is defined something called Monnier functions. So this is, I think this is sort of important. If you eventually keep studying condensed matter, you might want to learn about this. But that's mostly only if you really want to do things that are very, like, you know, have quantitative accuracy, chemical accuracy. You want to be able to make very accurate quantitative predictions about materials. Otherwise, I think this may be more detailed than is really needed. And so instead, our solution that we're going to use for this class is to, I'll put this in quotation marks, pretend that they're orthogonal. When I say pretend, what I really mean is this is an approximation. So we're going to assume we can use these atomic orbitals, and we're just going to ignore the fact that their overlap is not zero. In a few minutes, I will try to justify why that is a valid approximation to make. Okay, but for now, let's suppose we can do that. Okay, so we're supposing that. So this is going to be, so we're done with step one. We've chosen our orthonormal basis of single particle orbitals. So now we're on step two. Which is to compute matrix elements. So I am going to, for purposes of our current discussion, make another approximation. And we have only one orbital per site. For example, it could be a 1s orbital, it could be a 2pz orbital. I'm not going to be too worried about exactly which orbital it is. I'm going to say we have some one orbital per site, and this orbital looks something like the following. Okay, so we have some angular piece, which I'm also going to ignore mostly. We have some polynomial in R, and we have an exponentially decaying piece. The only reason why I need to write this out at all is because I'm going to use this fact that it's exponentially decaying to help us make some more further approximations and to justify the one we already made. So that's why I want to keep this form in mind. But otherwise, I don't care exactly which orbital it is, just as it's one orbital per site. Okay, so now we have our set of orbitals. So we'll call them phi 1 to phi n on n sites. In principle, this n could go to infinity, it doesn't matter. And we want to compute.
But
matrix. Yes.
Is it like the same orbital on each site or? Could be like 1s on the first side, 2p on the second side, or something like that. What does the
we could do a calculation where we have a different one on each side, but for now I'm going to assume it's the same one on each side. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. But does the first approximation then completely follow from the second one? Like the second one seems to be a lot stronger, I suppose, because you could choose this particular orbital to fulfill the orthogonality condition.
I don't think that's true. I think that the if you take literally just hydrogen orbitals, I think that every orbital on each site is not orthogonal to any orbital on other sites. I'm not 100% sure that's true, but I think that's true. Is that right? No, I guess that's not actually true because the sign is like all the s orbitals should be orthogonal to all the p orbitals, or one s should be orthogonal to all the p orbitals. But okay, anyway, so there are some cases where it may be zero, but especially if you have the same orbital on each site, like they're all 1s, then certainly the first one would not follow. And we want that case to be included.
Do we need the basis to be complete?
Okay, that's a good question also. So the answer, that's sort of another approximation, is that we also don't care if the basis is complete. So in principle, yes, you need a complete basis if you're going to do this rigorously. But what we're trying to do is sort of consider the basis that captures the states that electrons might actually be in the physical system. So like, you know, in principle, a complete basis for hydrogen atom would have like, you know, 1s, 2s, 2p, blah, blah, blah. And so you have all these NLM states. In principle, this n can go as high as you like. You could include, you know, n equals 1,000. But no particle will ever be in the state n equals 1,000, right? In a real system. Or at least, you know, not except in passing as part of some interactions. So basically, the fact that our basis is not complete means we're ignoring states that in practice will never be used anyway. Does that answer your question? Okay,
so we can eliminate the high energy Hilbert space.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, we keep only lower energy states. Now, of course, the reason why it might be not just the 1s or something is that if you imagine you have, a classic example is, let's say, carbon atoms. So if you want to look at a crystal of carbon, then let's suppose that we are on the like hexagonal lattice or something like that. Then, so C has 1s up and 1s down filled. And those interactions are like an inner shell core electrons, and they never do anything. So we can just ignore them. And then it has 4 valence electrons. Three of them form what you would call in chemistry language sigma bonds between the different sites in the lattice. So like this bond, this bond, this bond. And then there's one left over. And that one left over is the only electron we're going to care about if we're talking about what are the energies of mobile electrons in carbon, which determine all its properties, conductivity, and so forth. So yeah, so in this case, like the relevant orbital might be like a 2bz or something like that. So there's for each individual system, you could reason about which orbital you should have, which ones you can ignore and which ones you can't ignore, and that's going to be different from system to system. But for now, all of this is more complicated than we actually need. We're going to assume we have one orbital per site, the same on every site, and it has some exponential decay, e to the minus r over a, and that's all we need to know. OK, so now let's compute matrix elements. So suppose that I have, I raced the Hamiltonian, of course. OK, but let's suppose first that we're going to look at the diagonal elements. And remember that, so this r, I don't think I forgot to write that before, but r is the distance between sites in my chain. So this is a sum over sites in the chain. This is an orbital on some particular site I, and then this is the momentum and position of one electron. This is my single particle Hamiltonian. So now I'm going to separate this into two parts. Right, this should be minus ze squared over 4 pi epsilon naught x minus I times r by I minus Z square root of 4 pi epsilon naught, blah, blah, blah. Sum on J not equal to I. Phi I 1 over X minus JR by I. Okay, so this piece is easy because this is just this is an eigenstate of this operator, since this is just our single atom Hamiltonian. So all we get here is just the energy En that corresponds to my orbital. And then this whole piece I'm going to call delta E or delta En. And it's some complicated thing, which you get by doing all this, all these integrals and so forth. But we don't really care what it is because it's the same on every set. So you can think of this as doing first order perturbation theory, basically.
Yeah, sorry, you might have already said this. Did we take periodic boundary conditions?
I haven't said that. For the current discussion, it doesn't matter.
Then how do we know it's the same on every the same delta E on every site?
Okay. It's either periodic boundary conditions or an infinite chain. It doesn't have ends. Put it that way. But it could be either periodic with a finite number. Okay, I guess I said finite number n, didn't I? I did. Okay, so yes. Good point. Okay. So indeed, we'll say periodic boundary conditions. Thank you. Okay, so we have some, basically, what this tells us is we have some En, which is our original hydrogenic energies, plus some delta En. And these are our diagonal elements, which are the same for every orbital. Okay, so now let's consider sites, matrix elements that's not on the diagonal. So we're going to have something like phi I b squared over 2m minus same sum. Okay, I'm now going to call this constant A. Times sum of j, 1 over x minus jr times sum phi l, just to have distinct indices. Maybe, okay, let me switch these. Okay. That way we're getting our phi I and phi j as we want. Okay, so I think it's not immediately obvious what to do with this. And we're not going to try to actually calculate it, but we're going to try to understand which terms we can ignore and which terms we can't ignore. So we've already said that phi I phi j is approximately zero if I is not equal to j. That was our first assumption we made about our orbitals. So we want to make assumptions that are consistent with this one. And this thing is roughly e to the minus R over A for sites that are separated by one. So between I and I plus one, for example. So in other words, we're saying that that e to the minus R over A is approximately zero. So we want to compare things to this quantity. Okay, we're now going back to our matrix element up here. Suppose that J minus I, absolute value, is bigger than or equal to 2. Then we get e to the minus R over A squared, which is even smaller. So we should also ignore it.
But here we this exponential minus R by A is phi I phi j, right? Means we want the whole matrix element. Means the operator in middle can, I don't know.
Yes.
Can
it... So okay, yes. So that's right. Okay, so it's even smaller, so we should ignore it. Except that okay, so you're right. I'm gonna still make the statement for now. And so this is like, so okay, this is not going to be, this whole argument is not rigorous, what I'm doing now. This is we're trying to get a conceptual understanding. So I think for conceptual understanding, this is good enough. In practice, this may turn out to be wrong. Okay, that's what I'll say. Okay, but now let's consider the case j equals I plus 1. Then we can write this this whole thing as, again, separating out the part that's the Hamiltonian just for site j. Something like this. And we're going to try and see how does this thing compare with just phi I phi j. So it will be larger because of this sort of 1 over x behavior, right? So what we're going to imagine is that we have a chain of sites, and we have an orbital on this site, and we have an orbital on this site. They have some overlap, which is very small. But then we also multiply this by a function which looks like this. This is my 1 over x for the case where this L puts this 1 over x factor on site I.
Aaron, can you just say the first term, phi I, en, phi j, we're taking this not to be 0 right now? In order to compare it to the second term, or why? Because j is not I.
Right, this is equal to 0. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So sorry. Yes, I was just simplifying this because since you can actually get that this is the energy acting from phi j, but then you get the overlap and it's 0. Right. So yeah, if we write up what this sum looks like, we have the overlap of our wave functions, but we also, it's augmented by this factor, which is like an infinite function at the site of one at this site, or an infinite function at this site. And there's also infinite functions, you know, of course we have the same thing where the infinite function is located at this site or at this site, but all those terms don't really contribute because the wave functions are so small at this point that you multiply something that's exponentially decaying by this infinite function, it doesn't really do anything. But on the other hand, on these two sites, it really actually enhances this integral quite significantly. So in that case, I'm going to define a quantity, which I'll call t, which is equal to a times this, we'll call it phi on site I, 1 over this phi I plus 1 plus phi I 1 over x minus I plus 1 are phi I plus 1. And this, as we said, is substantially larger than just overlap phi I plus 1. Thus, it is a consistent approximation to set phi I phi j equals 0, but t not equal to 0. Okay, so now let me quickly go back to the question that Manu, I think, asked a minute ago about why we ignore this term. So in principle, we actually don't have to ignore this term because the same enhancement that you get from this 1 over x could apply to this term also. So you also could get what we call t2. Which is something like e to the minus r over a times t. So that's something which we could choose not to ignore, but it is much smaller than t in general. There are caveats, of course, in real materials where there is, so I assumed that we have this 1 over r kind of potential. But in real materials, you can have complicated things like screening effects that they're called and other things, which we're not planning to get into in this class. But that could sort of change which assumptions are valid, which assumptions are not valid. So this is just the simplest possible case that I'm talking about here. OK, so let's summarize.
Maybe yeah. Just for physical picture, so we're saying the two electrons on two lattice sites, they don't see each other, but one electron does see a bit of the potential of, like, not the electron, but the potential on the other lattice site.
Yeah, it sees the potential that came from the nucleus, so nuclear charge.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But not the, no, it does not see any other electrons. That's right. That's our non-interacting approximation. So these are not free electrons. They're subject to a potential, but they're not interacting because that potential doesn't have anything to do with other electrons. So to summarize, the matrix elements we found, we're saying is that the on-site gives us some energy E. If we're off-site by one, we get minus T. The minus sign comes from the fact that the potential is negative. And zero otherwise. So that's our matrix T. Looks like this. Note that because of periodic boundary conditions, we get this minus T in the two corners. Then this gives us our H, which is normally written this way, sum on I of E times, E times CI dagger CI minus T times sum of IJ in this angle brackets. So this angle brackets, what this means is nearest neighbor pairs. CI dagger CJ plus CJ dagger CI. Now I've written it this way with the nearest neighbor pairs in this IJ with angle bracket notation to show that the logic we just used applies more generally. It's not just in 1D, but also would apply, for example, in two dimensions. You'd have this kind of term for every pair of neighbors. So usually, we ignore the first term. Because since it acts, as we see here in this matrix, it's just an identity operator, all we're going to get is E times the number of electrons. So it doesn't really do anything. So this is going to give us what we call the tight binding Hamiltonian. And this is going to be our fundamental model that we're going to be using now for the next week or so on all kinds of lattices in order to find energy levels, eigenstates, and so forth, and then which we'll compare with the free electron that we studied before.
So the end result is that we can kind of think about it like an icing model, almost. Where instead of up or down, it's like there's a particle or there's not a particle in that orbital.
Yes, that's right. Okay. That's right. Exactly. Yes. Okay. So yeah. Let me actually use that then to start the next piece, which we only have a few minutes to get started on. But yeah, let's start with this picture that that Charlie was just saying. So, of course, before I do that, this is also a good time to ask more questions if anybody has other questions about this. So everything I just did, in some sense, it's not going to be necessary for the rest of the course. Like, you can just assume we have this tight binding model and do things with it. But I think it is important, of course, to understand where it comes from. So
in the beginning when we said that H could be replaced by just a single particle Hamiltonian, that part, yes. I'm not very clear. Why could we do that again? Because you said that T is a projector, T is like PHP.
Yes, right. So the statement of why we could use this method to find H was because I showed that this, this matrix element equal to Tij, right?
Mm-hmm.
But let's suppose that I instead, you do this. Like that.
Mm-hmm.
Since this state has one particle, then that means that P1 acting on CJ dagger 0 is equal to CJ dagger 0. And the same thing here, this is equal to 0 C1. And therefore, this thing is equal to that one.
My question is that why is our T equal to P1 HP1, something like that? But what you're saying is that if we evaluate P1 HP1 and or we evaluate H, it's the same thing. Okay, I see.
That's right. And this P1 HP1 is like writing my Hamiltonian I started with, except I only have one electron.
Yeah. Got it. Yeah.
Okay, great. Perfect. Yeah, you're right. I was a little bit unclear about that. So yes, thanks for asking it. The picture we end up with after all this derivation is just like Charlie was saying, that we have some lattice of sites. Each one has one orbital. And our basis states are, for example, 0, where no orbitals are filled, C1 dagger 0, which is, in other words, where the orbital phi 1 is filled, C2 dagger 0, et cetera, up to CN dagger 0. So this is our one particle basis. And then we have, of course, we continue on to the two particle basis, and so forth, just as we had in our sort of more generic systems we've discussed before. So the first thing we want to do with this is to understand what are the eigenstates and energies on various lattices. Which falls into the general category of band theory. That's what this subject is called. So our first example is indeed the one-dimensional chain, which can be written as H equals minus T sum on I, CI dagger, CI plus 1, plus CI plus 1 dagger, CI. We assume there are n sites And we have periodic boundary conditions. So that if I say CI plus one on site N, N plus site N plus one really means site one. So our procedure, which we're going to pick up actually next time, so we're not going to continue, we basically have time for today, but we'll pick it up on Thursday. Is to use what we proved in yesterday's class, that to find all the eigenstates of this many-body Hamiltonian, we only need to find the single particle eigenstates by diagonalizing the matrix T. So our procedure is one, we find single particle eigenstates. And then two, find the many-body states, as well as the same quantities we found for the free electrons, namely the Fermi energy and the Fermi momentum. And then after we do that, we're going to pick it up again. So I guess on Thursday, we'll do one dimension, and we'll start in on two dimensions. And then next Monday, we're going to finish talking about two dimensions, including sort of some very complicated cases. So that's going to be, this is going to be this band theory topic is going to be basically Thursday and Monday. And then in the second half of next week, we're going to explore some interesting and weird things that can happen with band theory. Okay, so that's it for today. I will see you in the tutorial in, I don't know, an hour or something. I don't remember exactly when it starts. Otherwise, if you have questions, I'll stick around for a few minutes. And if not, we'll see you later in the tutorial.
Would you say that the diagonal matrix is kind of the kinetic energy, and then the off diagonal is the potential energy?
I suppose that the way we the diagonal part certainly includes both potential and kinetic energy, right? That came from the full Hamiltonian acting on each atom, basically. Then the hopping piece, this T, you're right, it only came from the potential. But somehow, it's still going to give rise to states of energy due to non-zero momentum. So I wouldn't really, the way we derived it seems to come only from potential energy, but what we'll find is that you get similar effective kinetic energy due to electron states having finite momentum. That's a confusing answer. I think we should postpone this question until after Thursday's class, where I'll be off something concrete to point to so I can be better able to explain what I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question. Okay. So I was trying to think about how you'd maybe add more than just one orbital at each site in a way that kind of made sense. And I was just thinking, if you make a new chain, one for every orbital, and you kind of argue an electron can only go between the orbitals at a fixed site because of angular momentum conservation or something like that, would that, does that make sense?
Yes. So that is one way you can do it. Okay. So, I guess the one answer is yes, that's a very good way of doing it. The other answer is you're kind of trying too hard when you do it that way, actually. So what I mean, so all the stuff I did sort of deriving this model was to sort of convince you that this is an interesting model, interesting and useful thing to write down. This is not just some like junk that I pulled out of nowhere, but actually has some physical origin. But the way that it normally works, if you you're a theorist and you think about, it'd be interesting if I had two orbitals per site, then what you would do is you'd write down, let's see, I'm going to have H equals minus T1 sum on I of CI1 dagger CI plus 1, 1 plus the Hermitian conjugate piece minus T2 sum on I of blah, blah, blah. And this is, you have CI comma 2, and this is your second orbital, and you have a different T, and like, you just make stuff up. That's the way that these model buildings usually work. And it has some physical, like, you want to have some physical reasoning for it. So like, I'm being a little too cynical, I think. Just making stuff up is not exactly right, but it does sometimes feel that way.
I know what you mean.
It depends on who you are talking to. If you're talking to somebody who does quantum chemistry or who does like a density functional theory kind of stuff, then they'll really think about it basically the way that you said. Not necessarily think about a separate chain or whatever, but like, they'll go through the whole process that I did today and actually calculate for different types of orbitals what should all of the different Tij matrix elements be. And you can do this calculation. You can define, you can calculate the matrix elements we talked about for between 1s and 1s, and between 1s and 2s, and between 2s and 2s, and you can do as much as you want. And you get some very, very complicated Hamiltonian, which this T matrix, basically all the elements are non-zero, and the more of them you take into account properly, the more physically accurate your result will end up being. But if you talk to somebody who's like a theorist at the Perimeter Institute, the distance from real materials is a bit too large to ever do a calculation like that. And so it's more like the closest you'd get is, like, if you're talking about high TC superconductors, you'd say like, I have like, there, the hopping is probably between D orbitals. And D orbitals have certain like phase patterns, which might tell us that T will be different for hoppings in the X direction versus hopping in the Y direction, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's like these Tij can acquire phases and so forth. And so there's some phenomenological explanations why I want to use T that's not just a uniform real number. For example, but that's about as much as you would do as a like theorist who might be at the Perimeter Institute.
Okay, that makes sense. And I guess just because I thought about it, and maybe you don't have a good answer, but you know, I've kind of been thinking about the Ising model as like a Z2 valued field theory. Could you think about like multiple orbitals as like a 2 to the n valued field theory or something? First off, do you think that's a good way to think about the Ising model, or would you not think about it that way?
I'm not sure I actually understand exactly what you mean.
Sorry, I just mean like a field theory where instead of like a real number, it's like valued in Z2. It's like a zero or a one. But you're still thinking about it as a field almost.
I see. I don't think I have a good answer for that question, actually.
Okay, never mind then. No worries.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep. If you define a Z2 number on real space, will that cause mathematical difficulties? Like, you do not have a good definition of analyticity. So I think people usually consider Z2 numbers only on lattice.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And again, are fields actually differentiable ever in QFT?
Yes.
But for like a typical field configuration, they're continuous but nowhere differentiable usually. Oh, but you said analyticity. Okay, I see.
For Z2, you cannot even do continuity, right?
Yeah, I see now.
Well, there exists a continuous function, it's just a trivial one.
Yes.